Woo-hoo Hype, not your ordinary wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey sort of podcast. Welcome, everybody, back to our latest episode of Who Hype, a Doctor Who podcast brought to you from the folks at Hypable, HYPABLE.com. Our podcast talks about all things with the Doctor Who universe, and right now in particular, we're doing our instantaneous reactions immediately after watching the latest episode. And tonight's episode is called The Rings of Akhaten. Am I saying that right, Tarek? Do you think I got it right?
I think so, yeah.
Because I know I've been pronouncing it like Akhaten. Like, for the last 2 weeks, and when I heard it on the promo the other day, I was like, well, I've been doing that wrong for 2 weeks, so they really ought to give a pronunciation guide earlier.
Yeah, they really should.
In any case, in this episode, it was Clara's first proper visit with the Doctor. They're going off-site to this alien world planet orbiting the Rings of Akhaten, which I'm going to stop saying because I'm just going to mess up saying it. I'm just going to let everybody know I'm going to mess that name up throughout the entire episode. So just give me a bye on this for now, guys. So it was Clara's first proper visit to another world. So it's her first time really seeing, you know, that the Doctor is absolutely, what he's saying is absolutely correct, that it's not only a space machine, but it is a time machine, and she can truly and absolutely go everywhere in time and space that she wants. Just to give a really quick brief recap before we get into our instantaneous thumbs up, thumbs down, or thumbs sideways with the episode, I just want to make sure I tell everybody how to get in touch with us. You can get in touch with us by sending us a tweet at WhoHype. You can email us at whohype@hypable.com, or you can put a comment on any of the posts over on hypable.com. We absolutely read everything over there. And in fact, we like to read a lot of that instantaneous commentary coming to us from our British friends right after an episode airs. You guys are fantastic. You give us some really great feedback right away. Joining me today on the podcast is Tarek, and we also will have Natalie coming on. So before we get into our episode discussion, why don't we talk about our instantaneous thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways reaction?
Oh, definitely thumbs up for me. I actually really enjoyed the whole episode, and I kind of enjoyed it more than last week's Bells of St. John, just because I liked the story and like the fact that they went to another alien planet with the whole space station thing. Like, I feel like we haven't seen an alien space station in a long time. And so I really liked seeing that whole atmosphere and seeing how they played everything out.
I have to agree with you. I really loved the space station. I mean, it is Doctor Who, it is the BBC, and we all know, you know, they don't have a bajillion dollars. But I have to say, I was really, really impressed with the quality of the aliens in the space station. It didn't look like they just recycled all of the alien costumes. Like, it wasn't like you went, oh, look, there's a modified Ood head. You know, it looked like they really created a lot of things from scratch. There were a couple little things here and there that I thought were repurposed. But by and large, to me, it looked like a lot of originality going on. The depth of the set was really good. I mean, and you mentioned it too, that in particular, we haven't really had one of those alien world visits for a while. And I really feel like the last one to me on this level was when Amy with the space whale. Remember the space whale
yes.
episode?
Yes. I
felt like we haven't had something like this since Amy and the space whale. And I thought this was just such a better quality. I really, really did. So for me, this one was definitely a thumbs up. And I agree with you. The pacing, I felt, was much better than last week's story. And I know that sounds weird because it was kind of fast-paced, but I just felt like there was a different energy and a different chemistry. And this one really rolled with it more so.
It felt a lot more epic. And it felt like the thing that they're trying to save or the thing that they were witnessing was more important for some reason. And, you know, for, I don't know, like, the Wi-Fi was obviously, like, an important monster, but for some reason it just felt more epic in this episode.
Yeah, I think part of what that has to do with, and I think this is a great episode for kids, you know, because in the UK, Doctor Who is really aimed predominantly at kids and a show the entire family can watch. And I know in the US it's not quite viewed in that same light, but I felt like this was like a great show for kids to get on board with, and to have, you know, the girl who is playing Mary, I thought she was really engaging and really sharp. Like, a lot of times when you're dealing with kid actors, they may not always be the best. You know, she was actually really pretty good.
Oh, yeah. She was really good. Whenever I think of a kid actor, my first instinct is to think about the horrible kid actor on Desperate Housewives. Like he was horrible. He was, like, the worst actor ever. And, like, I felt bad because he was a little child. But it was good to see a kid actor who knew what she was doing. She was really, really great.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, Natalie, are you on with us? What did you think about this? Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways?
Yeah. Thumbs sideways towards a thumbs up. There were some bits in the beginning that I thought were really... Like, I don't usually notice special effects and stuff like that. And this wasn't a special effect thing. What you said about the different aliens was quite true. Like... they were all, like, quite non-recycled and, you know, whatever they did in the creature workshop, they have, yeah, definitely got some new stuff going on. And so I liked that. But there was something about it, I sort of didn't realise what the point of it was till quite far in, if you know what I mean. And I'm like, where is this going? Like, this is whatever. I don't... Though as soon as she took the child aside, I'm like, and sent her back, I'm like, oh, you've just sent her to be a human sacrifice, haven't you? Yeah, you have. So once it all started to heat up, I really liked it. It wasn't my favourite of a companion's first adventure, if you know what I mean. It wasn't my favourite of, oh, showing the companion the world, like what you said about the space whale and even Rose's first trip into the future. I kind of like the space whale episode, not so much the structure of the space station, but the story. This one I didn't like the story as much as Amy's first space adventure, probably, but... I did really like it, and I liked the end, sort of the end game of it, in the sense of the Doctor's big kind of emotional monologue about how his soul wasn't, you know, something that they wanted. And so there are definitely moments in it that, like, yeah, I felt very strongly about.
Yeah, it definitely had more of, I guess you could call it a gravitas than, like, other episodes. You're right. And it did take a little while to figure where all that was going. And you're right, there are a lot of different, you know, instantaneously I started thinking about the Amy's first, not Amy, geez, I was going to say Rose. Rose's first episode with the Ninth Doctor, where she goes to, like, the space station and it's the whole moisturize me thing. And I think about what the aliens looked like there, and it was kind of sparsely populated, to the space whale, where that one was not always one of my... There were elements of that episode I liked, but as a whole, I didn't love that episode. And then you saw how much it progressed to this. It's just... It's really... Clearly, the BBC has more cash now than they used to be able to do a better job here.
And I love the fruit. Like, the blue growing... The blue glowing fruit was awesome.
It's like, look, it's a blowing snow... blowing... Oh, my God. It's a... Oh, that was so awful. Oh, it's a glowing snow... Never mind. I'm not even going to say it. I'm just going to screw it up. Just forget it. Never mind.
Glowing snow globe.
Thank you. That's what I was going to say. Thank you. The other thing that was kind of big on this episode was Murray Gold and his music. I thought the music was actually quite good. I mean, it wasn't an overabundance of it, but I thought that just those choral arrangements and everything, I mean, not only could the kid sing, the kid could act. I mean, it was great to find somebody with some level of depth there. It was interesting. It did remind me a little bit of the Ouds. And remember the Ouds with Doctor, Your Song is Going to Be Over Now? And the guy who was, like, the male chorus guy almost repeated that line verbatim. I found that very interesting. Did you guys get, like, an Ood-like, like, flashback vibe there, too, for a second?
Vibes of both the Ouds. I did. Well, the singing, those choral arrangements, those kind of haunting, you know, singing through time and whatever always reminds me a bit of that. But it also reminded me a bit of the episode with the Sycorax and the day we arrive on the planet blinking and step into the sun, you know, you know that scene with the kind of stadium. It kind of reminded me of that a bit as well.
I was hung up every single time I saw the audience. I was looking for that one monster that I saw when he was introducing all the monsters to Clara. There was one that looked almost exactly like an old, what's the name of the alien, the robot, Cybermen. Yes.
Oh, Cybermen.
Yeah, there was one alien that looked almost exactly like an old Cyberman, And it looked like a recycled Cyberman costume, so every time I saw the audience, I was actually looking out for him, and I wasn't focusing on the they do actually remind me of the Oods, now that you think about it.
Yeah, there was another one, too, that was a little bit of a recycle. The one that, in the episode where it's the doctor's daughter and Jenny and everything, and I think it's the Hoth, I think that's their name of the alien in there, where they have kind of like the little test tubey thing on the mouth. Like, it wasn't exact, but you could tell they did a little repurposing there of stuff.
Yeah, I noticed that, the one sitting next to them in the stadium. I'm like, is that a Hoth? No, it just kind of looks like a Hoth. They've made it out of a Hoth, I think. Yeah, but they must have so many costumes just... you know, of all this weird stuff. One thing I found a bit odd about in the marketplace, when he was, like, running around shouting people's, the names of the species and stuff, I'm like, he was kind of treating them like they were, like, animals in a zoo, not, like, actual other people, like, if you know what I mean, like, being all amazed. Imagine if he ran around human,
like, London, oh, that's like, a human!
Oh, look! Right. It's a Chinese person! Oh, it's a dog! Oh, you know, that person's got curly hair! Oh my god! Kind of thing, which he might do, you know, but it just the way he was sort of running around being like that about the different species of aliens.
And he was very loud about it, too. He wasn't like,
yeah,
that's a thing and that's a this, but he would walk up to them, oh! That was odd.
Yeah, which is sort of odd in canon, you know, that he would suddenly be that amazed. You're right, he's a little more cool with, like, you know, he's met these species before, because, I mean, and in fact, he's been there before. I mean, granted, he's excited about being there, but he's been there before. He mentions that he's been there before with his granddaughter. Anybody who is only familiar with the reboot era of Doctor Who, the very first Doctor, played by William Hartnell, the story was that he was traveling with his granddaughter, whose name was Susan. And Susan was here on Earth with her grandfather, and eventually Susan's teachers kind of ferret out that there's something a little odd about her, and they all join the Doctor for an adventure, and things progress from there. So it was interesting that he did in fact reference Susan, and that he had apparently been to this place before. And again, like, I get that he's excited about it, but a little strange that he should be so amazed about it, which again is kind of a weird canon problem, which I think brings me to some other canon problems here. Did it bother you guys that the Doctor started barking at the alien and they were talking to each other by barking?
That was
because
so
of the
odd.
You mean because, well, do you mean because of the translation circuit of the TARDIS? So
exactly. Did that bug you guys?
Yeah. I did notice it. It just tied into what I said about the sort of treating them like not really like people. I'm like, this isn't really how this works, like, with other species that are people.
Yeah, I was, the first thing when he started barking, I was just like, well, okay, I was like, that was out of character, and then I was hoping for, like, maybe he was just saying it to say hello in, like, their native language, just so Clara could understand, and then he would talk to them at some point, just normally, but then it was just all barking, and I'm like, well...
Yeah,
okay, then.
It's just, and especially, I think I had mentioned this to Tarek before, what really bugged me about it is then Clara starts barking. It's not like she knows what the hell she's saying. She's just making random woof noises. And then the way that it's been established in canon, back when Donna traveled with the 10th Doctor to Pompeii, and, you know, she has the standard question of, well, how does everybody realize what I'm saying? You know, what I'm hearing. I mean, every companion goes through that, and the Doctor says,
I don't speak Latin.
Right, it translates. And she's like, well, I don't speak Latin. She's like, well, what would happen if I said actual Latin to them? And she does that whole Vini, Vidi, Vici thing, and the guy in the marketplace goes to her, oh, you're from Celtica, you know, and starts speaking to her slowly, you know. But I'm like, that just screws up canon.
Do you think it's a time thing? Because she never really spent too much time in the TARDIS. Like, maybe, I want to say, like maybe a couple of minutes to, like, less than an hour at most. Because she would go in the TARDIS and then out of the TARDIS. And so, like, do you think, is it something instantaneously where you go into the TARDIS and then you're given this ability so that when you exit the TARDIS you can translate? Or do you think she would have to spend a little bit more time?
No, I think it's instantaneous. And then the further problem is then she's obviously instantaneously able to understand Mary.
Oh, yeah.
And the other aliens and everything. True. So it just, so to me, it was kind of a hole. The other one, and this one I had mentioned to Tarek before too, and I had a problem with this, is when they get to the point where they're back at the temple location and weird little guard is there, you know, and they kind of knock them out with a sonic wave or whatever the force field is, they knock them out with, and they knock Clara and the doctor down, and he loses his screwdriver, and then they grab Mary, and then Clara, for whatever reason, is able to recover a little more quickly than the doctor, and the doctor yells at her, "Sonic!"
Yeah, Sonic, and I'm like, she doesn't know what that is.
Exactly. Yeah. I was like, she's going to start looking around for a fast food place. She's not going to look for a screwdriver. I mean, it's
because... Yeah, I did think that as well.
Yeah, I mean, they had the discussion of it's a screwdriver, and she asks him, oh, is that your spanner? Which, people who don't know UK English, that means like a wrench. So they had a discussion on tools. They did not have a discussion of it being a sonic screwdriver or what the sonic meant. I mean, maybe she could kind of figure out that he was holding something that was emitting like a vibrating noise, but I don't know that she would know what it was. So, I don't know. That bugged me. That definitely bugged me. So, some little canon problems here, Mr. Moffat. Fix those.
With the little kid, I did like her. I heard you guys sort of talking about it while I was listening to the last couple of minutes of the episode. I liked her, and it was very sad to me that she was like, as soon as Clara, like, said it, like, as soon as Clara was, you know, like, oh, you know, it's okay, you can go and do it, I'm like, it's all fun and games till there's a human sacrifice, isn't there? And then the arena kind of started, and I'm like, hang on, maybe she's not meaning to be sacrificed, because something happened and it seemed like something was going wrong. And then, you know, I'm like, oh, maybe that's not it. Maybe I've misjudged these people. And then I was like, no, it is meant to be a human sacrifice. This is what's meant to happen to each queen of years. But that little girl, like, just imagine that character, what she said to Clara, that she was scared. She didn't say, oh, I'm scared that they're going to kill me, even though she knew that was what was going to happen. She was just scared of getting it wrong and messing up stuff for other people, like how selfless she must be and everything like that. And do we even know what really happened to her at the end of the episode?
I mean, other than she's back on that, like, sort of home base area, I don't think we really know. And it's interesting, too, because she's sort of like this, she knows every song that's ever sung. She's like the receptacle of, like, oral history. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, if the god wanted her, she's been filled since her early years with all this knowledge.
Yeah.
So as if she needs to be sacrificed, like the fact that she has all this stuff, I guess, is the idea that she would know more than the average person, so it would then satiate the god. I guess
that's
the point of it. But it was interesting.
That she was okay with that. She was fine with that. I mean, not that she should have just gone ahead and been sacrificed, but just her, like, it's so sad that she knew that, and she was fine with that. She was just worried about messing it up and not protecting the other people.
Well, and you know what it is, too? Because the doctor even says it happens every 1,000 years. Well, something doesn't seem very real to you if it's 1,000 years off, you know? So maybe it's not what you think, or, you know, so I think maybe that's probably some of it also. Plus, I don't know that it was definitely a planned sacrifice, because the doctor said he'd been there before and they do this every 1,000 years. I don't think he would be very down with children sacrificing themselves. I mean, he was clearly not down with Mary doing that. So I don't know that every time you are automatically sacrificed to the gods, it's only if the god wakes up or something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And I thought that the guy who was the chorister over in the temple end had kind of struck a bad note, which I wasn't sure if he sung the bad note and the ground shook, or the ground shook and he struck the bad note. But I think it doesn't always go badly.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. I feel like it wouldn't necessarily be a sacrifice every single time. But what's weird is that when they messed up the song, I watched it twice, and both times it didn't feel like they messed up. It feels like they just stopped. Like, maybe they were just really good theater actors and you couldn't tell when they messed up. Like, I couldn't tell who messed up the song, because they both stopped at about the same time.
Right, like they got distracted or something. Yeah, like
exactly.
I felt like they got distracted on some level. That's true. So, you know, about this whole thing, is one of the things that they establish very quickly in this episode is something that, you know, was kind of established with Amy too, is that the Doctor always has a soft spot for children and children crying and children in trouble. And I don't think there was ever a doubt in any viewer's mind that the Doctor was going to save Mary. But clearly, this is Clara.
It was for me.
Oh, I didn't think so. I thought I knew he was going to save her.
You know, when he ran away, when he took her, when Clara was like, oh, we're going to do something, and he left, I thought, oh my God, he's totally changed. He's like, he's just being like, I'm not being responsible for this anymore. I'm not dealing with this. I just want Clara.
Oh, no. I thought he was running for the TARDIS. Oh, no. I didn't think he was going for the space coaster. I thought he was going to get the TARDIS, which, to be very honest with you, I don't know why in the hell he didn't just get the TARDIS.
Yeah, neither.
I thought he was getting the TARDIS, but I think it was good that he explained to Clara what they were doing. You know, and he explains, you know, we don't leave people, and kind of, you know, sort of starts to explain his life philosophy to Clara on the fly, because now it's not like he could have the nice sit down talk. It's like, hi, having an emergency with children, here, let me like quickly explain my life philosophy to you as we're going along. I feel like, you know, the Doctor, under it all, is a very kind-hearted, very, like, he wants to do what's right. He wants to do the good things, you know, kind of like how Rose Tyler puts in the very first episode, that, you know, in the very first season of, you know, he stands up when nobody else says, no, this isn't going to happen. He's going to do it. He's going to show you a better way of life. The quote of, we don't walk away. I love how that just so succinctly puts what sort of his overall philosophy is, which makes me realize right now that I skipped one of my favorite parts. What we usually do is when we talk about like what favorite quotes and things we have are, I think for me, my favorite quote was the idea of we don't walk away, because it just totally sums up the Doctor's philosophy. Did you guys have a favorite quote from this episode, either a serious one or a funny one?
I had two, basically. One was funny and one was less funny, but this sort of both, they're both the Doctor's odd speech patterns, but one was in regards to funny-wise, opening the extremely crazily, you know, unusually heavy door when they were talking about sort of the key pattern, and Clara says, can you do that? And he says, technically, no. In reality, also no. But still, let's give it a stab. And then later, this just seemed like a mirror of the later quote where she ask, you know, he's kind of like, oh, there's nothing you can do. And she's like, oh, you're going to fight it, aren't you? And he's like, regrettably, yes. And then I can't remember exactly what he says, but he says something like, that does seem to be what I'm going to do, or something like that. And it just, the speech pattern seemed like a real mirror of that quote. And one was very funny and one was very, very sad. Like, and just the way that he sort of said that regrettably, yes, I was like, you really don't want to do this anymore, do you? Like, it's like, you will do it. And you always will do it, but you're really tired of having to do this and you would like to just show up and have a nice time.
I'm like racking my brain trying to think of things, and I just think Clara trying to bark. She had no idea what she was doing. She just sounded like she just goes, woof! I'm like, what? Girl, you don't know what you're saying. That's
good,
basically
point.
It.
You know what? I was just saying, because Tarek, you just added something into the document, and I think this might be a really good point to get into it. There was something also that was a little interesting and unusual this time out, and that was the fact that Clara tried to get back into the TARDIS. Now, in the past, the Doctor has given various people TARDIS keys. She didn't have a key, but I didn't feel like the TARDIS would per se be unlocked to a companion. But the fact that the TARDIS didn't want to let her in, that was interesting. Do you think it didn't want to let her in because she was with Mary and the TARDIS didn't want Mary in there, or the TARDIS didn't want Clara in there? I mean, and then Clara comes up with a statement, oh, I don't think you like me. What do you guys think is going on with the TARDIS?
I feel like the TARDIS senses that she is an anomaly, and therefore...
Yeah, this is exactly what I was going to say.
Exactly, yeah. She's not going to... Like, the TARDIS isn't going to want to let something like Clara in. Like, the TARDIS has an idea of what she is and doesn't feel safe around it, and lets her in when the Doctor is with her, because the TARDIS trusts the Doctor but not Clara.
Yeah, I think it's to do with whatever is wrong with Clara. The same way that, you know, the Doctor, it kind of reminds me, the Doctor's reaction to Jack Harkness after Jack becomes immortal.
Yeah.
You remember how he was,
right,
like, really cold to Jack? Yeah. It reminds me of that.
Yeah, how he says the TARDIS tried to shake you off because you're just wrong. You shouldn't be.
Yeah.
That's a nice parallel. I feel like there are so many parallels, like this time out, like last episode and this episode. Like, I just feel like this whole season is going to be the season of, like, parallels. And maybe that has something to do with the whole run, you clever boy, and remember. Because I just feel like we're getting these parallels to so many things constantly. Who knows? Maybe that's going into it a little more. Clara's mom or her family, we you know, because we talked a little bit about the whole TARDIS, like why the TARDIS doesn't maybe like Clara. And after the doctor's like been stalking Clara's timeline, he goes into the TARDIS and all these pictures of Clara flash in front of his eyes, all the different incarnations of her, and he's sitting there, it's impossible, she cannot be, she must not be, but she is, and God only knows what that means.
With that, I thought it was meant to be like he was sort of tracking, he sort of went and stalked her through her life to check that she had grown up with a normal life. If, you know, how could she just be born and grow up to that age with a normal life when she kept being in other places as well? Like, does he think that she's just popped up fully formed at various points throughout time? Like, that seems to be what he thinks about her.
Yeah,
at the moment.
I think he was trying to stalk her to see if she was missing in time for an era. You know, like, was she, like, does she have a normal pattern? Because he obviously goes back to the beginning of Clara, which is her parents meeting, and that was the whole thing with the first leaf and the memories and all of that there. And then you see her as a little kid, and then you come forward to realize that the mother dies, and this is actually kind of significant. The mother was born in 1960, and she died in 2005 when Clara was 16. So that probably explains the missing 16th year in her book, and it also explains Clara previous episode saying that like 2005 wasn't a good year for her. So I get
did she
all
say
that now.
I don't remember
or
that.
Didn't she say that or 16 wasn't a good year? She said something like that 2005 wasn't a great year. It was definitely in the previous episode. So you look back and you're like, okay, you look at the mom's tombstone, and the date of death on the mom's tombstone is March the 5th, 2005. Now, as soon as I got that, I immediately went off to the IMDb to go figure out what was the date of the very first Doctor Who episode in the reboot era, and the date of that episode was March 26. So I said, oh, I discounted it. I was like, it has nothing to do with anything. And then some important responders on Hypable pointed out something to me, that they had done some Googling, and they were getting March 5th as the day that Rose first met the Doctor. And I'm like, well, where are you getting that from? Because it's clearly a March 26 transmission. Well, the reality is that there is a time marker in the first series. In the first series, you know how Rose flies off with the Doctor and she calls Jackie on the phone saying, you know, hey, Mom, I'm going to be staying at my mate Shireen's for the night. See you in the morning. And then the Doctor promises to take her back the very next day. But the reality is he takes her back an entire year later. The flyers in that episode list the date that the last time Rose Tyler was seen was on March the 6th, 2005. So, if Clara's mom died on March the 5th, that means she died the same day that Rose's department store blew up, which seems awfully coincidental. So, was she at the department store? Did she run into a rogue Auton in the street? You know, it can't be coincidence that she died, her mum died, the day the Doctor met Rose Tyler.
That would be really weird if it was a coincidence. Like, that would be very, very random and very, very strange. Yeah.
Now, mind you, I can't figure out what it has to do with anything other than it can't be a coincidence, but I can't figure out, like, I have no crack theory here right now. So I don't know if you guys have a crack theory on that. I have, like, no crack theory on what that means. Although I have to say, I am mildly annoyed by the fact, do we not know the father's name?
I don't think so,
not yet.
We don't know. No. We know the mother is Ellie Ravenwood, because we saw it on the tombstone, and we saw the book that Clara has apparently used to be her mother's, and the mother had it starting at age 11, which I feel like, you know, I am the world's worst math person. I feel like Stephen Moffat is torturing me with numbers right now, and my brain is just going to get full with this stuff very quickly. But I'm just, like, this is all going to come together somehow. I just don't know how.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like that if it is a coincidence, that then they've made an error, if you know what I mean. Like, they should have checked for a date that wasn't a significant date already in the Doctor's history, because I feel like, yeah, if it is a coincidence, it's going to lead people round a bit of a fancy dance, if you know what I mean. Like, it won't potentially cause some confusion.
And we already have the other Clara, the Victorian version of Clara, with the November 23rd birthday. You know, so that's like when Doctor Who first came onto TV, and was that a homage or real, or like, I don't know. I'm wondering, are we paying homages? Are we not paying homages? Is it linked to something of a greater purpose? It's really hard to tell.
I feel like it can't be thoughtless, like, especially Clara's birthday. I feel like it can't be like a thoughtless, oh yeah, that's the date. That's not, you know, whatever. Like, I'm just curious as to, like, if he's so curious about her backstory and her life, like, yeah, she's currently alive in this time period right now, and he's gone back and looked at her childhood. Why doesn't he go back and look at the childhoods of the other ones that have died, of Oswin and of Victorian Clara? If he's that curious of it, like, why does he think, because they're all alive in their time frames at some point, if you know what I mean. Like, they haven't. At any point, he could travel to a point in their life where they were alive.
Right. I mean, like,
so
Oswin might have been harder, but why would Clara... Yeah, like, Oswin might have been harder, but why would Clara have been hard? I mean, couldn't he have just gone back, like, a week or something like that? Yeah, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's interesting is...
save them or whatever, but if he needed to track down anything, you know, like, if he need... Maybe he didn't want to go looking for dead people after he knew them and they died, and, you know, maybe it was just that, but... But I kept wondering why, if he's, you know, that curious about how impossible she is, why doesn't he look at the others as well?
And I'm wondering if Clara ever decides to, like, travel to the past. We don't know how many, like, we've only seen two Claras in the future and in the past. And so, like if Clara ever decides to just travel to the future on Earth or travel to the past on Earth, I'm wondering, how does the Doctor not know
where another Clara might be?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's going to be really interesting to see when she chooses to go back or forwards in time on Earth, if she's going to have to deal with the paradox somehow.
Exactly. Here's the other thing that I thought was a little interesting, because it was a repeated line, and just by the time you heard it the third time, you figured it wasn't coincidence. You heard Clara's mother exclaim, "Oh my stars, are you all right?" when she met Clara's dad for the first time. And then when the Doctor gets whacked with the soccer ball, she says, "Oh, my stars," again. And then Clara says it. I mean, obviously she could be picking up on her mother's speech pattern when she's there with the Doctor at the space station. So I'm just wondering, "Oh, my stars" is kind of a weird thing to be saying. Like, seriously, the only other thing I can think of it from, it was in the old, like TV series Bewitched. I mean, and I'm like, I'm sure they're not paying a homage to Bewitched. But I just wonder if there's just more to it than that, especially since, like, Clara's mom has that whole talk with her about, like, Clara remembers that the time when she was lost, and her mom has that entire talk with her, and she tells her, you know, Clara tells a story about how her greatest fear was being lost and not knowing where she was, and the mother says to her, "It doesn't matter if you are in the jungle or in the desert or on the moon, however lost you will feel, you will never really be lost. I will always be here, and I will always come and find you every single time." And I just felt like somebody might as well been walking through the episode with a giant signpost that said foreshadowing at that point. I just felt it was kind of obvious. The other thing that I thought was kind of hilarious too, as soon as she's going, "I will always find you," I was like going, "Oh my God, it's Once Upon a Time." If, you know, with Snow White and Prince Charming with "I will always find you." I'm like, no, stop crossing over. But I just feel like there's so much more. I mean, do you guys get this, like, with Clara's mom, that we're practically being clubbed over the head?
Yeah,
with Clara's mom being somebody.
Yeah, I feel like there might be something, like, that she was I mean, the doctor would know if the mother was, you know, a companion or something. It's not like the mother was a companion and knows all these secrets, but I feel like there is something there.
Right. I mean, she cannot obviously be a former companion because clearly the doctor would recognize her. So that has to be, I think, instantaneously discarded. But yeah, there's just something else there. Somebody else brought up to me on one of our threads that they thought the woman looked a little bit like Sally Sparrow. I don't think she looks like Sally Sparrow, who I think she looks like a little bit, but it's not the same actress I checked. Was Sally Sparrow's friend who got sent back in time? She looks a little bit like her, and her voice sounds a little bit like her, too, but it's not the same actress.
Definitely feel like her mother is going to have some sort of history. Maybe not her directly, but, like, her family has some sort of history with the doctor. And I feel like that's...
With the doctor or with the supernatural world, you know, the time and space world, if you know what I mean, rather than maybe I haven't met him specifically, but that maybe she's, someone was displaced...
Yeah, like, I feel right, like, yeah, I feel know. Like with that, somewhere, she, like, her family has been, has been doodling in time and space somehow.
Yeah, and the mother's name, too, like, and it's been driving me crazy, because I've been Googling it, and I can't come up with it. The mother's name was Ellie Ravenwood, and then obviously, Oswald, which is the last name, but the maiden name was Ellie Ravenwood, and for some reason, the word Ravenwood is like, I'm going, that's familiar. And I can't place why it's familiar. I tried Googling that word in relationship to Doctor Who, and I got nowhere fast. But I just feel like we've heard this word before, or I've seen it before. And I, for the life of me, I can't place it. Did you guys get a vibe like that at all?
Well, the second I saw her name, the first thing I thought of was Beautiful Creatures, just because that's what the last name
right.
and.
So Yeah.
And yeah,
oh.
exactly. So that's it was familiar for me in that point, but I can't for the life of me think of what significance it has in Doctor Who.
Maybe that's what was in my brain. I don't know. I just kept feeling like I've heard this name before, and it was really driving me crazy. What do we think about Clara, that her greatest fear is being lost? And did we see that kind of evident in last week's episode that you know, that was very much true because it didn't seem like she was afraid she got taken. She was afraid. She was saying she was afraid that she didn't know where she was. That's an interesting fear.
Perhaps that comes from her, something about her not really knowing where, you know, something deep in her not knowing where or who she is, like based in the original, whoever the original base model Clara is.
See, what's interesting to me is that, like, she claims that, like she doesn't like being lost, but like she goes off on in this world that's just kind of like brand new to her, and like she follows this little girl, and I'm like, okay, like she's exploring, so I guess like, and she has this little girl with her, so technically she's like she's not lost. But one of the things that struck a chord with me, and I don't know if it struck a chord with either of you, but like the fact that the doctor just kind of like walked away randomly and left her on her own, and the only reason she wasn't freaking out was because she found the little girl who ran past her. And I feel like it was very odd that the doctor would just walk away without telling her where she was going on this new world, because, like, she's a new companion, and this is her first alien world and her first, like, really time out exploring the universe with the doctor.
Right. Like rule number one, don't wander off, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so it was very, very odd to me that the doctor would just kind of walk away.
Well, something that happened twice, I was sort of suspecting it to happen twice, was that moment when the doctor walked away, like, because it was after, like, Clara was like, I don't have anything to pay with, and the doctor's like, ugh, and he kind of goes off. And then at the end as well, when he was actually standing and facing the sun, I don't know if either of you got this, but each time it felt like he was steeling himself up to hand over, I kept suspecting that he was going to hand over, like that he was trying to talk himself into handing over Amy's glasses.
Exactly.
Did either of you think of that at any point?
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
And I thought at that moment when Clara wandered off, he was being like, oh, I don't want to. And then he sort of goes off to think about whether he would and sort of loses track of Clara because his head's not with her. It's thinking about that.
Completely. Because I understand him not giving up the sonic screwdriver. I don't blame him for an instant of not giving up the sonic screwdriver. But I did think you have Amy's glasses. You have Amy's glasses. And yeah, I think that's very interesting that he, I mean, for once made a selfish choice of not giving something up that clearly would have gotten them passage on that bike. Yeah. That
and I feel like that was definitely something that they, like, obviously probably did on purpose, because they showed him wearing the glasses in the very first, like, 5 minutes of the episode when she's, like, her parents. And so when he's stalking her parents. And so it's very weird that, like, there's something about those glasses that's just extra, extra special, other than the fact that they're Amy's.
I just kept suspecting that he was going to pull them out and that they would, like, and he'd be like, no, I can't. But he didn't. It wasn't even said, but I was still thinking it, and I think he was as well. Like, I really do.
You know what's interesting, too, is you're talking about the doctor kind of being stuck and still suffering. I felt like he had sort of a catharsis at the end. Like, he was willing to sacrifice himself, you know, to the god who would, you know, because he feels on a level that's, you know, he's 1,000 years old, so he's had 1,000 times more than anyone alive gain experience, good, bad, or whatever. And he's basically, I felt like he was saying to the god, here, take it all, take my pain, take, make all this go away. And I felt like he was saying he's really, really suffering and was hoping that the god would just lift the sorrow that he's been feeling, and it hasn't fully gone yet. I don't know. Did you get that kind of vibe?
I kind of got that it was a bluff, like that he knew the god couldn't deal with it, like that it would destroy him, if you know what I mean. That it
Right. I thought it would work, but I felt like he was thinking he was going to get something out of it too. But yeah, no, I agree. I think he was really hoping, okay, there's so much of me, he's not going to be able to stand it, you know, and if he dies, so be it. But I felt like, yeah, he was really hoping, because I mean, I was watching like the tears running down his face during that too, and I have to say that did make me cry. This is the second time that Stephen Moffat has ever gotten me to cry since he became the showrunner. The only other time I have cried at a Stephen Moffat Doctor Who episode was The Angels Take Manhattan, and I was just a blubbery mess through like the last 30 minutes. But that bit did make me cry, as the Doctor is talking about his whole experience and all the pain and that he's experienced of like watching everyone around him die. And
that scene, I didn't cry in it, but I came pretty close. Like when he was, I think the only reason I didn't cry in it is because I was so middle of changing around. It was like literally then that I was having to like change around computers, and I definitely, if I'd been sitting there just watching it properly, I probably would have cried, because he did that speech, started out very, you know, like, come on, come and get me. But then he really broke down, and it was very awful.
Yeah, the original, it originally started off like with sort of like a bravado, you know, of, yeah, you know, I've had this, I've had that, go on, come and get me. And then it starts to become very, very deeply. And then by the end, he kind of wraps it up with how he has knowledge that must be never spoken and will make parasite gods blaze. I'm wondering, because the god did feed on him so much, are there some things that got out there that should not have gotten out there? I wonder if that's like a side theme too going on.
I just wanted to ask, I think I might have missed significance of Clara feeding the sun the leaf, if you know what I mean. But like, why was that such a big thing? Was it just because it was someone's life? Would it work with the memories of anyone whose life was full of what ifs, if you know what I mean? And I don't understand why, if the doctor's thing worked, why she had to go ahead and do that, if you know what I mean.
I mean it worked partially, but the god was still alive. Like it didn't work as well as the doctor thought it would have. And I think that anybody who had anybody who had kept a memento that had significance, like the coinage that they use there isn't coinage, you know, it's something of value that has memory and meaning to it, so the god is tied to that. So to me, anybody who had a possession that was from a parent or from somebody they were incredibly emotionally attached to, whose life was cut short, it would have worked. I don't think it worked because it was Clara per se, but I think it worked because that item was so permeated with the energy of a person whose life was cut short and the endless possibilities of what if. And as the doctor said, what if is infinity. So that's important.
I feel like the reason the doctor's quote unquote sacrifice didn't work is probably because I feel like the parasite just got scared and just stopped because of what the doctor said and because of all of the things that he knows and all of the experiences that he's had. Like, I'm sure that he has more than enough, like, of those things to have satisfied the parasite for like 100 years or something, mm-hmm. or like 2,000 years. But I feel like the parasite just stopped on its own accord because they were scared of what knowledge the doctor would have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they paused. Yeah.
Exactly.
Here's the other thing that I noticed, a little bit. Because you know how the bartering item is Clara's mother's ring initially that they give to get the scooter, yeah. and then she gets her ring back? I remember way back when we first got the still images, I thought it was really odd that she was, like, wearing, like, personal jewelry in it, and I blew it up. The ring is an infinity ring.
You totally did! You were like, oh, she's got jewelry. That will be sick. I remember that, Laura. You were. You made such a big deal of it.
I blew the ring up. It's an infinity ring.
You were way too good.
Sometimes I impress myself. There are some times that I get it woefully wrong. Believe me, I do. But this time, I was good, folks. I blew the ring up. And it is an infinity ring. That's interesting. And I also, what I did tonight is I went and I blew up the pictures when Clara was Oswin. And she is wearing a ring, a single ring in those photos, and I tried to blow it up and they're grainy and I can't get a good look at the ring, but I swear to God it's the same infinity ring. There's something about this.
My last question about the ring actually was, when he does give it back to her at the end, do you think that he acts kind of really weirdly when he gives it back, like about what he's saying when he gives it back to her about the people looking after her, that it was you know, he acts, to me, it seemed strange, and
yes.
I wondered if it was a lie and that he actually went and traded for
it.
Maybe did trade Amy's glasses for the ring.
It was a strange vibe. I will give you that. Absolutely was a strange vibe. And actually, it was kind of funny as he was saying it and saying, they're thankful to you, they're also thankful to you. The thought going through my head was, well, at least this time the companion's not dead, because what went through my head was discussion the doctor has with Wilf about somewhere off in the galaxies they are singing songs to Donna Noble, and I'm like, well, at least this time she's not dead or incapacitated permanently.
It just made me think that there was something odd about the way he said it, and I wondered if it was a lie in some way that he'd maybe traded for the
I could to get see
the
ring
that back, and it was a personal thing. And I think the one thing as well that you'd put down that we sort of didn't talk about is after the doctor's speech, after he brings her back, like Clara's speech calling him out about stalking her and being like, I'm me, I'll come with you as me, but you can't feel weird about it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I like that. I felt like this is the first time the doctor needs the companion more than the companion needs the doctor. Like, she doesn't have as much of a compelling reason to be with him as he wants her. I thought that was really kind of cool that it is so much more on her own terms than it is his terms. That's a real difference, I feel like, with her.
What she said to him about comparing her to a ghost or, you know, whoever she reminds him of, it's not her, it's not Clara. And he seemed to accept that, but it also, you know, starts the question, like, well, is it, though? Like, you know, is there something she knows or something she doesn't know, if you know what I mean? Is she going to have to accept that she's not herself?
Right. Yeah, no, it's a good question, and I agree with you. I just feel like there's more in play. I'm just loving this season. I just feel like it's funny, because I know we always talked about on a couple of episodes about how under the Russell T. Davies years, we loved where there were like little hints of things put throughout the season, whether it was Bad Wolf or whether it was Torchwood or whether it was like John Saxon being there, and you might or might not pick up on it. I feel like we're getting back to that, and I like that, because that's something that I've missed. So I really feel like we're getting little nuggets of something. I just don't know what it is, and I kind of like that I don't know what it is. I'm good with that. Moving into our news section now, we've had a couple things come up this past week. Not a lot, but one is of incredible note. We do know that they are filming the 50th anniversary special. We do know some cast members. Actor John Hurt, not to be confused with actor William Hurt, they are two entirely different people, has been cast. So is Joanna Page. Joanna Page is probably most recognizable to American viewers if you've watched the movie Love Actually. The naked woman who spends time with Martin Freeman on like the art house film, that's her. Only she's not naked in this.
Good.
They've also brought back the Zygons, which is a alien that the fourth Doctor had to deal with, so they've brought the Zygons back at least. Also, as previously announced, they also have David Tennant and Billy Piper back. And the reason I think they were so glib about all of this is because they knew they were going to be shooting out in the open and people were going to be able to identify them. So that's why they just announced all of that. I have a feeling they're only going to announce details with the 50th as to what people would have seen anyway, so they're just going to head it off at the pass. But if stuff happens behind closed doors, they're not going to tell us, is what I think it is. The other thing that we're still waiting on is news of the fan convention that's going to take place in time for the 50th anniversary. I want my information, darn it, because I want to book an airfare. So they haven't gotten out any more info on that, and I desperately want it because I want to go. But the biggest piece of news, and this is one that I'm sure you guys will react to too, is the fact that Christopher Eccleston, the Ninth Doctor, is apparently not going to be coming back for the 50th anniversary. And we had felt originally like very much he would, because initially he was very resistant to the idea. And then, about 4 or 5 months ago, his tune started to change. And he was saying things like, I may have more to do in Doctor Who. And he agreed to be on the audio drama that Nicholas Briggs was doing. And then all of a sudden, this statement came out yesterday from the BBC that says, Chris met with Stephen Moffat a couple of times to talk about Stephen's plans for the Doctor Who 50th anniversary episode. After careful thought, Chris decided not to be in the episode. He wishes the team all the best. So, interesting. It's sort of the BBC's way of saying, yes, we did invite him, but he turned it down.
He said no. Yeah.
So it's like interesting. And they issue a statement on this and they don't issue a statement on John Barrowman. Like I'm not finding.
I think Barrowman's covering up. I think Barrowman's done something where he's like, oops, I've said too much and now I have to say the opposite.
Yeah, I don't understand why you issue a statement that Eccleston is definitely not in it. I don't get it. I mean, if he doesn't want to be in it already, he doesn't want to be in it. Personally, I think he's going to regret not being in it, like, because it's a piece of history.
I think he doesn't
want to
be in it. Good riddance. His attitude isn't great.
Right.
But
I feel like it's a piece of television history, and I think he's an idiot for not wanting to be at least a part of television history. Like, 25 years from now, is he going to regret his decision?
He doesn't seem to really respect it very much, I guess he took it before he knew how well the reboot was going to do. Like, he thought it might be some little cult drama or something.
Right.
I don't know. Like, but he seemed to not really be too keen on everything that happened.
Well,
I don't know what aspect it was exactly that he didn't like.
Well,
but, you know, if he's not keen on it as a franchise, then...
Right. Well, thing on it, too, that I guess that I feel, is that it's Christopher Eccleston. You know, if you can have people who are British actors of the stature of Academy Award nominee Sir Michael Sheen, Academy Award winner and nominee Sir Ian McKellen, who are willing to be on this show and just have their voices used.
Welcome to Doctor Who. Yeah.
Like, seriously, you can't come back for even if it was a tiny cameo. Like, really? Suck it up,
so
dude.
Mad.
Like, do it for the fans. You know what? It's bigger than you are.
Like, you are not... how can he be more of a snob than Ian McKellen?
Right.
Like, it's just...
Well, and even if he doesn't like showrunners...
Like, he doesn't have the right to be that snobby.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
the thing that really gets to me is that... Is, he left the show because of all, like, the politics and, he didn't agree with the team and he didn't see eye to eye with them, which is, like, okay, it kind of makes sense, but I still kind of think that he's kind of a douchebag. But, like, if you don't agree with the people you work with, then it's not a good environment to work with.
I'm
so
just,
that I understand.
Right.
But the fact that he it's a completely different team.
Right.
And the fact that like he hasn't worked with any of these people, and he's, it's just like, oh no, I don't like Doctor Who. Go away.
Yeah, I mean, because he definitely would have had a couple of episodes where Moffat was the writer. I don't know if Moffat was on set doing directing or anything like that at the same time, but you know, he didn't like the team, and presumably that was Russell T. Davies' team. And look, I'm not Russell T. Davies' biggest fan as like a human, as him as a human being, and him as the attitude he's had towards some of his stories and some of his fans, and like just his attitude in general about the way that he believes television should be, or things like that. I don't particularly like him. I think he's great at writing characters, but I don't really like him. So maybe Eccleston just really didn't get along with Russell T. Davies, and that's, in my view, understandable, because I don't think I would either. But it is a different team now, and so I don't understand why he wouldn't. Presumably he had a meeting with Moffat and stuff and was like, you know, oh, could I work with you? No.
And even if it was not even 5 minutes, it's, as I said, it is a piece of iconic television history. It is the longest running sci-fi show in history. The fact that it's a show produced in the UK that has this honor is mind-blowing. Like, to me, you're turning down a piece of history that is what your craft and your career is about. I mean, to me, you know what it's akin to me? It would be like if Colm Wilkinson decided, you know, if I'm still alive, I'm not going to be around for the 50th anniversary of Les Miserables because I didn't like Cameron Mackintosh. Like, it's bigger than you. Like, at a certain point, it is bigger than you. What is a cameo of your time to do this? And it's not like he's so overriddled with other projects that he can't do this. I don't know. My two cents, in any case, I think he lives to regret this at a certain point.
Even if he just in the opening scene, like, he just popped off and then someone else 5 minutes later had popped on, you know?
Like, literally, 5 seconds, like, one glimpse of him is all anyone needs. Just a glimpse.
Well, here's the irony. You know, you just know that they are going to use the images of all the doctors in this, you know, because they have archival
footage.
They're going
to flash up on the screen.
Yes,
yeah,
so
yeah.
Here's the ridiculous irony of this. Whether he wants to have been in it or not, he's still going to be, because you know they are going to, in some manner, flash the image of every doctor that has been. It's going to happen. And hilariously, you're still going to get your royalty from that because your image gets used. I mean, it's just, it's, no, you know,
it's, oh,
so
no.
I don't know. My two cents, I know maybe it's not always a popular opinion and certainly folks are free to disagree, but I just feel like he's being very short-sighted here. We're going to go to our spoiler section, which is really kind of small this week, folks. So if you want to skip ahead and miss our very limited spoilers, you can skip ahead to this time code. 1 hour and 5 minutes.
Spoilers. Spoilers. Spoilers.
Okay, so I'm back from the spoilers. There are really very little spoilers. There's just some of the filming that was seen for the Doctor Who 50th anniversary special. Joanna Page, who we referenced before, was seen on set in Elizabethan dress with a red wig, which really makes it sound like she's Elizabeth I, because why else would you be stylized in that fashion? We also saw both versions of the TARDIS that were David Tennant's version and Matt Smith's version, in case you're wondering what the differences are. There's a slight variation in the windows, and Matt's is a much richer, brighter shade of blues than David's is. So both versions of the TARDIS were around. So does that mean it's the 10th Doctor, the 10th Doctor clone? Is it a flashback to the 10th Doctor and Rose Tyler before the events of Canary Wharf? You know, there's a lot of speculation.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they have the TARDIS makes me think it can't be the 10th, you know, the 10.2 and
right.
10.2 and the Rose. But now I wonder if they're going to just be at the beginning and then the real story is going to be with 10.2, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
it's going to
be
a flashback and then
right.
the real story.
Right, it absolutely could be. David Tennant was wearing the very classic brown suit that we're used to seeing him in the white sneakers, and that was very much the outfit of the 10th Doctor, whereas the clone was always in the navy blue suit, but presumably he's changed his clothes somewhat. Who knows? Like I said, speculation there. We also saw an image of a helicopter with the TARDIS, and I'm not clear whether the helicopter was in the scene or they were using it just to steady the TARDIS. I'm not 100% on that one. But the one thing they also did see was Jenna on the anti-grav motorbike that we got a glimpse at in the Bells of St. John. And she was on it, and the way they were doing the shot is it makes it look like she's driving at full speed, like, towards the TARDIS, like she's going to drive the bike right through the doors. So we don't quite know what's up with that, but it's cool because apparently this anti-grav bike is coming back again. So
what
that's
is with motorcycles and Clara? Like, I feel like, like there's that in the 50th, apparently, and then there's the motorcycle that was in the Bells of St. John, and then this weird motorbike in this episode, which is like, well, not a motorbike, but like it was a ski thing. But like, it's weird.
Like,
is
it seems
just me?
No, I think you're right. It's like a theme. I was like, I literally wanted to say, yo, like Clara, Luke Skywalker called. He wants his, like, you know, he wants his transport back. you know, yeah, it's, I do feel like it's a theme. Definitely. I don't know. I think that's what this is this year, is a lot of like little itty bitty drop-ins to other things we've seen. So I think that's totally what it's about, without question. So we did have one piece of mail this week that dealt with the spoilers we dealt with last week, so I thought we could do with it now. And one of our fans wrote in from Belgium. This is from Shanna from Belgium, who wrote in how she's a pretty new Doctor Who fan. You know, after giving a couple of goes and breaking down in sloppy tears, yes, we understand, she had to take some breaks and then finally came back and she's finally finished the whole series. And Matt Smith is currently her favorite Doctor. And what she wrote in to ask was, I'm really writing in for the 50th anniversary, and I was wondering if maybe you know anything about Alex Kingston being part of the 50th. She's not announced to be a part of it, and she's not filming it, it seems. River is definitely my favorite character right now, so I'd be pretty disappointed to see if she's not part of it. How awesome would it be for Rose and River to meet? Since there are rumors of season 7 finale being called the Funeral of River Song, as well as a gravestone with River's name on it, I'm a bit confused and worried. They also keep saying that the series 7 finale is a lead up to the 50th, and I'm thinking that episode will be very River centric. Alex Kingston has also revealed that she knows the Doctor's name, so it's safe to say that all of this will be in the finale. So she wants to know, again, this is Shanna from Belgium, about what we think about all of that. I would love to see River meet Rose. I think that's a really awesome, fantastic idea. I would love that. Whether or not Alex Kingston will be in it, I mean, ironically enough, Alex Kingston is now on the cast of Arrow, which John Barrowman is on the cast of. And I love Alex Kingston to death. She has got the world's most god-awful American accent. It's like she can do the accent or act, but not both at the same time. And I love Alex Kingston. I am such a fan. She's stiffer than a board in Arrow. I don't know if the Funeral of River Song will be the actual title or it's the working title, but I really do feel like we're winding down River's time. And I don't know if she will be a part of the 50th. I would love it as a flashback, if nothing else, but I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think everyone would basically love if River met Rose, just because it's the first companion that fell in love with the Doctor versus the Doctor's wife, which is very tricky. And I feel like that would be perfect, but I don't logically see it happening, unfortunately, just because I really do feel like River's timeline is going to end before the 50th, personally speaking. Like, I just have, like, a feeling that that's what's going to happen, and maybe I'll be, like, slapping myself when I see the 50th anniversary, but I feel like they're making it so purposely these characters don't meet, maybe, which is a little sad.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. It just, yeah, it is. It's a little sad.
Yeah, I don't think she'll be in the 50th because I think that, you know, of whatever's coming in the finale, but I really don't want that to happen. As I said last week, I feel like River's story doesn't feel satisfying to me, and I wish that we had more of a focus on it. I always wanted her and Jack to have an episode together. You know, now that they're off on Arrow, maybe they could conspire, but I always wanted her and Jack back to have an actual episode of Doctor Who together, or even Torchwood if that had happened. But having the Doctor, River and Jack in the TARDIS, especially if it was the 11th Doctor, would have been amazing. It's all, yeah, it's all a little concerning about River, and I don't really want it to her to die. I mean, obviously we know she's dead or whatever, but I don't want to have that all happen again. Speaking of Alex Kingston, though, I forget if I told you guys when I went to the Doctor Who Symphonic Spectacular at the Sydney Opera House at Christmas, which was hosted by her and Mark Williams, and it was really bizarre. It was great. It was so beautiful, and there were so many parts where everyone cried, and, you know, because obviously they had the musical suites, and they showed clips, and some they just played the whole scene, including the dialogue, where it was a particularly strong musical overture from a scene. But they had one focusing on the monsters, and they had the monsters all come out and dance around. Like, they had Daleks, and they had Cybermen, and they had the Vampires of Venice, and they had the Silence. And after they had this big thing where the Silence came out and, like, menaced everyone, the next time that Alex came back on stage, in her evening gown, like, that she was hosting in, she had, like, bare arms, bare chest, bare face, she had tallies written all over her arms and face, even though, because she'd seen the Silence, if you know what I mean, even though she was in her formal gear, and I loved that.
That's so great.
That's just some Alex Kingston appreciation for you there. Yeah. I really loved that.
Yeah, no,
that's awesome.
Yeah, and I love her too. Like I said, I feel bad that I don't think she's doing it in Arrow, because I do, yeah. I love her. I've been a huge fan since Moll Flanders in ER, so I feel bad that I'm not such a fan of her work on Arrow, so.
Was she British in ER?
Yes.
She played a British She played Dr.
Elizabeth Corday, who was from the UK. Yeah, so she had her own accent.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah. So, anyway, now we're going to move into our mailbag that is not filled with spoilery email.
So, Maria says, I think this episode is very much like The Idiot's Lantern, about the Doctor's tasting things. He did the same thing in Amy's first episode. Although it was under different circumstances. Oh, and might there be something up with the cookie that he bit into and left behind? Remember the apple in Amy's first episode? Now, this is, for you guys listening, this is for the last week's episode, Bells of St. John, since we didn't get to do the feedback for that. But I definitely think that there's something there with him sniffing everything. And I don't think maybe not so much with the biting into the cookie, personally speaking, but there's something up with him like licking and smelling everything.
I agree too. I felt like he felt something was off with it. I also think that because he licked the leaf, that it kind of got maybe like a DNA lead or whatever he gets to find Clara's parents from it. But I do feel he did everything to get a vibe from that room, and I absolutely feel like the licking stuff is absolutely a part of it. And shout out to Maria for referencing The Idiot's Lantern, because in that show there was also a motorbike. So, you know, things just keep circling around again.
Mikey G has written about the Summer Falls book that we discussed, and he says, about the Summer Falls book, it relates to paintings. Didn't Matt Smith say in an interview somewhere, when asked for a clue to the 50th, he gave the answer, paintings. Very interesting. Now, I haven't heard anything about paintings, but obviously last time we had a painting, we had Van Gogh, we had the exploding TARDIS given a clue of what was going to happen in that finale. The Summer Falls book has that stylized cover that's like a painting, but do you know anything more about the paintings, Laura?
Yeah, in the book Summer Falls, it is a painting that people can enter and interact with is just crucial to the storyline. There's in fact a whole post up on it on hypeable.com. If you haven't seen it, check it out. I'll even put it in the show notes. And basically, in this book written by Amelia Williams, it really comes down to, you feel like it's a manual on how to combat the great intelligence, only Amy now is smart, and because of the events of the Angels Take Manhattan, she knows she can't write it using real names. So to me, she has to write it as a fictional story with fictional beings, and part of it is like entering this painting and the way to combat the Lord of Winter, who I think is a thinly veiled version of the great intelligence. She kind of gives some very specific instructions, and it all involves entering and interacting with this painting. And Matt Smith, when he was on I'm going to say it was Jonathan. It was either Jonathan Ross or Graham Norton. I can't recall which chat show it was. And they were goading him to give him some hint about the 50th. And he said words to the effect of, paintings, that's all I'm going to say. Paintings. I've probably said too much already. Moffat will be killing me. So yeah, I think this is all going to tie in somehow. Don't know how yet, but I agree. I think that was very observant, and yes, definitely, I think this is going to tie in. And if you have not gotten the Summer Falls novella yet and read it, please do. It's 13 chapters long. It's a quick read, and you will not be able to put it down. It's definitely, definitely stuff there that will apply to the rest of the series. You're going to want to read it.
I'm going to get it this week.
Cool. It's just sitting in my Kindle waiting for me.
Waiting for you. I'm so waiting excited. For you. So, well, that wraps it up for this episode, folks. We want to say thank you very much for listening. Just again, a quick reminder to get in touch with us. You can tweet us at WhoHype. You can put a post on Hypable, HYPABLE.com. Or you can, in fact, send us an email at WhoHype@Hypable.com. So until next week's episode, I'm Laura.
I'm Tarek.
I'm Natalie.
See you next week, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye. Bye.